Made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today we explore this question: what is lost when a language is lost? More than 100 Native American languages are close to extinction. Our guest this afternoon, journalist and Oklahoma native Elizabeth C. As Elizabeth C. is a journalist and a writer, you would imagine, and you would be correct, that language is important to her. When she was a child, she says she liked the feel of other grammars. She loved the words she found in Keats's poetry. But it wasn't until she was grown and living in New York that she realized that in Oklahoma she had lived in the equivalent of a rainforest of linguistic diversity. Elizabeth C., a longtime staffer at the Wall Street Journal, is the author of Searching for Lost City, On the Trail of America's Native Languages. Early in the book, C. tells readers of what put her on the trail of native languages. She says she began to think about that rainforest of linguistic diversity, and she, quoting here, wondered if we had been deaf to dozens of poetries, if Oklahoma had a kind of wealth it had not recognized, a treasury of languages. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments for our guest, Elizabeth C. Join the discussion with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Elizabeth C. was awarded a 2003 New York Artists Fellowship from the New York Foundation for the Arts. Her work has been featured in several anthologies, including These United States and Floating Off the Page, the best stories from the Wall Street Journal. Her book, Searching for Lost City on the Trail of America's Native Languages, is published by the Lions Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Elizabeth C., thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me here.
Sure. 39 tribes officially recognized in the state of Oklahoma, and when you were there reporting, nearly a dozen didn't have a language. A couple questions here. How extensive were the language riches of Oklahoma, and how extensive are the language riches of Oklahoma?
Well, it varies a great deal. About two dozen tribes still do have languages, and most of those, in fact, have only 1, 5, 10, 20 speakers left. But at the other end of the scale, you do have the Cherokees and the Choctaws, who have as many as 10,000 speakers each. And so there's a great deal of wealth and diversity among, Oklahoma. The picture is very different for different Oklahoma languages.
Yeah. Of the languages still spoken, they seem to be so interesting, so fascinating. There's a language that has 10 genders.
Right. I mean, one of the joys of exploring this was seeing how languages sort of showcase the diversity of human thought and the possibilities, for putting together a language. It's of great interest to linguists, but also to everyone else, in terms of sound. I just encountered a language, not in Oklahoma, that's entirely whistled. In terms of grammar, you have languages that, as I said, have 10 genders, languages that have 4 past tenses or more, one for a few seconds ago, one for a few days ago, one for historical time, a few generations ago, and one for a kind of distant mythical time. So there are many different ways to define our world and to classify our experience, and languages offer a window on that.
Yeah. Well, this window that you opened for yourself by studying languages and reporting this book, Searching for Lost City, how has it changed how you see the world?
Well, it first of all, one of the greatest pleasures for me was finding out how vibrant these older cultures still are. A lot of times before I told, the news of the book was twofold. One is that languages are in danger, but the other news for a lot of people is that the languages are still here and that it's still possible to find people speaking them and living in these kind of older ways of life, ways of thinking. And so in some ways, it just gave me an appreciation for how many other kind of ways to live are out there and how many are kind of at our, not on some other continent, but right in our backyard, particularly in Oklahoma. But even in Illinois, there are tribes, in Minnesota and Wisconsin particularly, that are trying pretty hard to, that still speak their languages and are trying pretty hard to preserve them. In terms of my learning the languages, when I studied Cherokee, I focused more on some fairly subtle aspects of how it kind of classified the world. The way you had to think more about the way an object was related to you in space. Not to say it was walking, but is it walking towards you and away from you? And these are very subtle ways of conditioning thought. So I'm still sorting out how it will make me see the world.
Yeah. Tell us about a man you got to know by the name of Hastings Shade.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was deputy chief of the Cherokee tribe at the time that I met him. And he, like many Cherokees, he lives in a traditional world at the same time that he lives in the modern world, or he tries to. He's got his hunting bow in the back seat of his car, and he tries to kind of go fishing and kind of remind himself of the ways that, for instance, you can use a spider web to tell you what the weather's going to be, at the same time that he works in this very modern office. And he brought me to a place where he had grown up called Lost City. There I hoped to find, it was really called Lost City, and I hoped to find a Cherokee-speaking community there. As we toured, though, it became clear to me that the things that Hastings Shade was pointing out were mainly places where things had once happened and where people had once been, and that the community was being broken up, and I realized at that point that it was going to be harder than I had thought to actually find these communities where people spoke Cherokee. And I also realized sort of the importance of situating a language within a community, the idea that, language doesn't exist just in a classroom or a book, or it doesn't survive, in a grammar, but it has to continue within the life of the community, and that spurred a search for me that was community-based. I wanted to find communities where the language was still being used by old people and young people and everyone in between.
Yeah. Searching for Lost City opens with this sentence. Lost City is a real place back in the foothills of the Ozark Mountains. Hmm. How did you learn of this Lost City, and what, in fact, is there?
I don't think I found it on the map, though I think it is on the map. I heard of it first from Hastings Shade, I believe, but it became much more to me than a real place. It actually came to represent for me what I was looking for in Oklahoma, a kind of mythical lost city, a place where the language and the community would remain vibrant, and it would necessarily be lost from modern society, because it seems like languages have to be, because communities that maintain their language best often maintain a high degree of separation from the contemporary world.
Yeah, isolation helps.
Exactly.
Preserve a language, keeps it alive.
Yeah, and I think there were a few. There was one group, the Kickapoo tribe, that they never even wanted to talk to me, and I always heard they had a really great language, you know, that they, and that that kind of conservatism and closed quality, you know, to outsiders was one of the things that kept it alive.
Yeah. You were an outsider, and that was something that weighed on you. You had questions about your motives. How did you sort that out?
Yes, I wondered, I wondered if, of course, everywhere where I went, by definition, to talk to people, they'd have to switch into English to speak to me. So I wondered how I was going to see this thing that, you know, at the time I hadn't started learning Cherokee when I first started, and I guess that was actually one of the answers for me was that it wasn't that in order to really see these places, I needed to make a change in myself. I needed to actually start studying one of the languages, so I could experience the sheer difference of it myself in a more kind of visceral way, but also so that I could get people to talk to me. Which is not to say, I don't want to claim that I started going around interviewing people in Cherokee, but just to have the interest in the language opened some doors.
Yeah. Among other things that you talked with Hastings Shade about, names for birds.
Right.
This is terrific. I don't know if you've got the book there in front of you, but pages 8 and 9 in my notes it was a wonderful passage here. Tell us about that, and then maybe go from there. Tell us, what do the Cherokee names for birds say about the larger context in which languages exist?
Right. Well, Hastings Shade had done a paper about it, you know, and I've seen other sources that validate this, that Cherokees once had as many as 130 different names for birds, probably far more, a lot of the names had a meaning, like the mockingbird was the head eater, and that involved a myth that explained why the mockingbird had so many voices, it could imitate other birds, and so you didn't just have a name, you had having the name kind of located you within the culture. And I asked Hastings Shade, nevertheless, you know, I thought, well, you could still always translate these. Why would you need to know all these things in Cherokee? And he said that, you know, the Cherokee names had all this, so much information about the birds, about what they, you know, the impressions of what they ate and where they nested and how they sounded and what they represented. And so that the world described in the bird names was specifically Cherokee, and, you know, could only be explained, it was more harmonious to know the bird names and to live in the Cherokee world, whereas you lost a kind of clue to the culture when you lost those names.
Hmm. So when a language is lost, more than its vocabulary, its grammar is lost.
Yeah, right, exactly. I met another guy, a Kiowa guy, who told me about how all Kiowas call their great uncles grandfathers. And that reinforces those family ties. And this Kiowa man couldn't get leave from work to attend his great uncle's funeral because to his non-Kiowa bosses, this was not an important relationship. But to him, this was his grandfather, and language reinforced that. And the language reinforced the culture reinforced the language, and that was just an example of one of the kind of distinctions about the language that sort of helped you to live within the culture.
Yeah. You went to Oklahoma in search of languages in part, I think, because you had a desire to return home. In fact, you state that, and you write eloquently about this. Would you share with listeners a sense of what you were feeling at the time?
I was embedded in a kind of a modern world in which I guess working in the in a newsroom, I was surrounded by the news of this world, the kind of corporate dealings and the articles on how to buy a car. And when I learned about that these languages still existed, I actually had this sensation that that this actually was news, and that this was somehow, this was in a way something people needed to know. It was more important than a lot of the news that I got in the newspapers, which kind of said the same thing over and over. So I found it sort of a relief to get back to Oklahoma. Plus, this was home to me. I could sort of identify with people's nostalgia for their past, by exploring this terrain where I had grown up and learning about it anew, learning about this other side of it.
Yeah. Well, this desire for home, I think, is very interesting because I think we could liken language to a home.
Right, exactly. It's something that I was reminded of whenever I went back to Cherokee country, and it seemed to me that it was my home as well, that was one of the reasons, the things that drove me to look for communities where people still spoke the language, is it seemed to me that it was within the home that language would stay alive.
And language is a way of holding everything together.
And right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's harmonious. You have a more harmonious relationship with your surroundings in very subtle ways. There are, other languages. There are like California languages where they express direction in terms of upriver and downriver instead of, north and south or east and west, and that reflects their situation, their location within that particular river valley, is very tied to the terrain, and that seemed, somewhat true for a lot of these languages that have Indian languages that have such a highly developed sense of the natural world.
Yeah, language, you say, lives in the muscles. You want to explain that? Talk about that idea.
Remind me where I said that.
That was
when I was learning it, right?
Yeah, but also, it is in the world of dance. There's muscle memory. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
In the world of dance, there is a thing that dancers talk about: muscle memory. And language is this is a wonderful, it's wonderful to talk about language. Language is such a wonderful thing. It is so full of metaphor. And it exists in our very muscles, in how we speak, and also in our memory. There is also a muscle memory at work here.
Right. Well, I remember, I thought about this when I was trying to learn languages. Tripping over your tongue is such a literal phenomenon when you're learning another language, it's something that is just particularly hard to do when you're old. You have to keep training the language. You have to keep training your mouth to shape the words. And I think there's some evidence, scientific evidence, that our bodies become, that our faculties become shaped around certain languages, that, for instance, we start losing our ears start losing the ability to discriminate certain sounds that aren't part of our language. We find it harder to hear sounds that aren't in the language we heard, as we grow older, after childhood. And I'm not sure that our mouths literally shape themselves around language, but it certainly feels that way, and it's a kind of discipline, a kind of meditation to continually practice a language. And it also tells us something about the difficulty of bringing back languages if they're not learned by K kids when they're young, it's always going to be, it's possible, you know, older people can always learn, people can always learn languages, but it does get harder, and when kids aren't immersed in their native tongues, then, you know, then having classes that teach it is just a very distant second best, and that was one of the reasons why I felt it was so important to find communities where the languages are still spoken, and to try to keep them, you know, to make sure that these communities were kind of valued and sustained, because once it's lost, it's really hard to get it back. Whereas if it's still alive, but, you know, you can see the danger signs, you know, it's much more effective to just keep it alive than to let it go and then try to get it back.
Yeah, it can't exist in a jar on a shelf.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. And modern language revivals, you know, it often start with a committee.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's kind of, it's tough, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, what do you do? On the other hand, committees don't always, you know, that's kind of a rough
right.
way to keep something as vital as a language alive.
Right. Well, it feels very unnatural for people to have to think about a deliberate process for keeping this natural thing, this thing that just flows through their existence, you know, through our existence, alive, and to take steps. And of course, committees, you know, they are, they're often top down. They have leaders, and they, even by the nature of having a committee, means someone's in charge. But in fact, you know, language itself, for instance, they'll put people in charge of inventing new words. Well, we need a better word for computer. We don't want to use the English word. What will that word be? So people will brainstorm. But in normal kind of natural language life, those things are, you know, just kind of bubble up. They're slang. You know, a child will think of them and of something, and it'll catch on. And there have to be ways to keep the language kind of moving naturally. I think once it gets to the committee level, it's pretty hard to keep working with it. But one of the things that I saw that I did enjoy was a couple of young hip hoppers, guys who are rappers, basically, which is, you know, means that they're extraordinary speakers of English, but they were trying to use some of their native languages, which were mostly Seminole, but also Pawnee, in their hip hop music. And that, to me, was a very vibrant sign for the language. That kind of linguistic invention is what has to happen for a language to survive. And of course, you know, indefinably, like, it has to be cool for young people to speak it.
Sure.
And what I liked about that was that, you know, hip hoppers were making it cool. There's a lot of tension between the old and the young in these societies. Oftentimes, the middle generation is counted out. The parents are frankly just working too hard to think about this. The old people are the people who still have the language. The young people are the hope for the future. And how do you connect those two? That's really the question for a lot of these tribes.
Mm. Elizabeth C. is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Searching for Lost City on the Trail of America's Native Languages. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, you can join us with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Elizabeth C., a longtime staffer at the Wall Street Journal, author of Searching for Lost City. The book is published by the Lions Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Differences in generations are very interesting. Hastings Shade, who's a man of 62 years of age, told you that his sons speak Cherokee only when they have to. What are their feelings about the language?
Right. Well, that is just such a common story. I mean, there's been in many cases, you know, there was a very negative process, you know, occurred in Indian communities in which there were active efforts by outsiders, by boarding schools, by the state to keep Indians from speaking their languages. So a whole generation of people was trained not to use the language and to believe it was shameful. And then their kids felt that it wasn't useful to teach their kids their language. You know, they weren't going to get jobs, and they weren't going to be able to participate in this sort of modern life. And so a lot of that, those attitudes still persist. You know, there were a lot of people that age, you know, under 50, say, just, you know, don't really see it as a language for the future, and so they don't really want to speak it.
Interesting. And people were punished. We have to remember this. People were punished for speaking their native languages in schools. And there are some people in the book, I think, who you write about where this is evident in how they feel bifurcated. For example, Ken Gooden. Who am I today?
Right.
Am I Comanche? Or am I, you know, which world do I walk in today?
Right, exactly. He just, you know, looks at himself in the mirror in the morning and sees what comes to mind. You know, is he going to be the white farmer, or is he going to, you know, speak Comanche? He's got both of these things rolling around in his mind. And for so long, it was speaking Comanche was discouraged, that, you know, it takes the right setting, you know, to coax back these Comanche words.
Let's talk with a listener, caller in Danville on line 4, the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes, I have a question I've been thinking about. Is there any common root to languages in the United States? And also, I wonder if there was any connection to the Mayas, you know, the temple the pyramid mm-hmm. builders, because mm-hmm. all their teepees were conical shaped and mm-hmm. Almost reminded you of a pyramid. So I'll hang up and listen.
That's a great question, because I was so surprised myself to learn that there were once, or at least at the time of, say, Columbus, there were more than 50 language families represented in North America. Indian languages are staggeringly diverse. People, you know, tend to often think that they're all related, but the relationships are very difficult to trace. Just for a point of comparison, all of the languages in Western Europe today come from 3 language families. So to come from 50 language families is staggering. But that said, there are a lot of relationships between languages of North America and Central and South America. I was working with Comanche, which is directly related to Nahuatl, which is the descendant of the which was the Aztecs language. And while I don't know specifically what the ancient Mayans language was, I know that there was cultural contact, and scholars are right now unearthing a lot of evidence of influences from the very vibrant civilizations of Central America on particularly the southeastern Indians of the U.S. And also, you know, going all the way up the Mississippi River into the Midwest.
Interesting question.
So, yeah, there are relationships there.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for his call. Others are invited to join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. How many speakers does a language require to survive, to be a living language?
Right, that's a difficult question. A lot. There's a figure that gets thrown around that a language needs at least 100,000 speakers to survive. Of course, if that's so, then very few Native American languages would have a chance. I think only Navajo can meet that. But But there are other factors, like how isolated is the language community and how strong is its ethic of preservation. For instance, the languages of the Sea Islands off Georgia, like Gullah, which were spoken by much smaller numbers of people, persisted for centuries. And a lot of people, so I think there is hope for tribes that have, 10,000, 5,000 speakers. And for the ones with 100 speakers or less, the challenge is just, can we keep this going into the next generation? How much, not to even look so far ahead, but just to focus on speaker by speaker, each speaker, transmitting it to one more person.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I was, hello. I was curious about the availability of dictionaries in Indian languages. One of the reasons I ask is that I grew up in northern New Jersey, and I spent some time in the summer at a little town called Manasquan, which is an Indian name. There are a lot of Indian place names in New Jersey,
right?
Many more than there are in Illinois, I think. And apparently language or the Indians that were there were Lenape Indians, or mm-hmm. which is this part of Delaware Indians. But the language is Algonquin that they spoke.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen two or three different explanations of what Manasquan meant, and some of them seem to be fanciful, and some of them are related, and so on and so forth. So I was always curious to say, are there dictionaries, Algonquin English dictionaries, that kind of thing? Are they available, and where does one find that type of thing?
Well, yes, there are, and I was struck by that actually in New Jersey as well. I was very amused to find that, Hackensack was a Lenni Lenape word, this kind of mundane word, or Raritan or Tapan, so many place names in New Jersey in particular. Some of the descendants of that tribe do live in Oklahoma as the Delaware tribe. But there are a number of dictionaries, and it's one of the most vibrant fields in language preservation right now. Among on the academic side, is sending linguists out into communities to compile dictionaries. Meanwhile, of course, a lot of tribes are compiling their own dictionaries without any outside help, and then they're also collaborating. And I believe there is a Lenni or also interactive CD-ROM type things where you can hear a speaker pronounce a word, which is also very important given that the sounds of these languages are often so different. And I believe there's a Lenni Lenape dictionary on the web. I don't know the address, but I think it's possible to access it via the Internet. I know that there's a CD or CD-ROM type compilation of the Lenni Lenape language. Of course, in terms of researching place names, usually the best thing to do is to go to the place itself and look via histories of the place for the origins of the words. There's actually a place, there is a, something called, a work called Oklahoma Place Names, for instance, that was helpful to me. But yeah, there are a growing number of dictionaries of various languages.
Yes, well, this place that I was talking about is interesting. The local historical society, it gives one definition of what that name is,
mm-hmm.
and then I've seen in other books other definitions. They're somewhat related, but still different. Well, of course, maybe
it's hard to establish it. I actually met somebody with Delaware tribe who answers questions, which I could provide you that information in some way, because I believe the Delaware tribe of Oklahoma, while it has very few speakers left, has some people who can answer some questions about the language.
Well, that's interesting. We'll try certainly try the internet to see what I can find out. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And we'll give that listener a chance to hang up his phone and get back to the radio. And then, Elizabeth, I'll mention your website, which is another really good, nice resource for people interested in this topic. And that website is www.elizabethc.com. And Elizabeth is spelled, common spelling, and the last name C is spelled S-E-A-Y, elizabethc.com. Let's talk with another caller, listener in Martinsville, line 4. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
In your research, talking about language families a few minutes ago, with native languages, did you ever find a root language in either the Siberian tribes or perhaps some of the Chinese, old Chinese dialects?
Well, people are looking for that. I didn't find anything definitive. It's a really hot field also right now in linguistics, is figuring out the root, you know, the roots of these languages. And, you know, I think that some relationships have been established, particularly between the most recent languages to come to America. That is the ones that, you know, spoken in Alaska, and some of the tribes, some of the groups on the other side of the Bering Strait. But there have been so many migrations to America over, you know, people are still trying to figure out over tens of thousands of years, that the origins of most of the other languages have been somewhat lost to history. And it's possible, too, that the language now spoken in China wasn't the dominant language, you know, that long ago when they split up. So the roots could lie in some, the connections could lie in some really obscure place. And I think people are still working on trying to establish, you know, the sources of these languages. I remember being surprised to find that early on in the early colonial history of the U.S., a lot of Westerners, people like Thomas Jefferson and some of the, you know, royalty in England and Russia and France, were really interested in figuring out who the Indians were. Were they from, did they come from Atlantis? Were they part of the lost tribes of Israel? There were, you know, a surprising, it's been this really interesting mystery for hundreds of years.
Okay, well, thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Back to the previous caller, the listener in Champaign. You know, one of the things that we like to do in our culture is write things down, and the dictionary is a big deal to us. And I once heard someone say that almost if you're looking for a book to be found in every American home, it's going to be the dictionary. But, you know, writing down a language might not be the way others approach language. I know that I can't recall now the tribe, Native American tribe, that says to write down a language is wrong, because then you are losing, you know, the spontaneity of language. It becomes something stale.
Right.
And, you know, I can see both sides of this. Maybe you'd like to comment on that.
Right. Well, I did encounter, I think it causes a lot of soul searching when tribes decide to develop a dictionary. They usually, they often do it as a sort of teaching tool, but there's controversy because information traditionally in so many cultures has been transmitted orally, and that's the way, you know, information should be transmitted. And moreover, there are distinctions. You know, when you transmit something orally, you are able to distinguish between private and public information. Things like that are ceremonial and religious might only be translated to certain people. Things that are traditionally male language or female language might only be transmitted female to female, male to male. And there's a lot of controversy over language that is available to everyone. And people are often reluctant to write down, for instance, sacred aspects of, you know, language that relates to sacred aspects of the culture because they don't consider it to be language that, certainly not language that outsiders should read. And some tribes are coming up, I believe, with ways of limiting the information. For instance, they'll create a CD and put it in an archive, but they'll have the public archive you know, promise that they will limit the availability of that CD to people affiliated with the tribe.
Very interesting.
There are really a lot of issues that you might not even think of when it comes to turning, you know, trying to put a language in the into a dictionary.
Let's talk with another listener, caller in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I used to live in Panama, and the northern province of Panama is called Chiriqui, C-H-I-R-I-Q-U-I, and the capital is David, but the story was only, you know, I just got it verbally, was that there was a sergeant in the military, U.S. military, who was a Cherokee Indian, and he got excited by just the name, and he went up and did some research and discovered that there was an exodus from the Cherokee Nation in the United States that worked its way down the peninsula. Is that true, or do you know anything about it?
I think it is true. I've never heard about going as far as Panama, but there were definitely when the Cherokees were removed from the southeastern lands and sent to Oklahoma, there was definitely a group that decided to go a little farther. I was amused by the not amused but interested by the way people talked about different tribes talked about old Mexico when I was interviewing them. Mexico was this place that I guess for a while in the 19th century people felt was a kind of refuge. And in fact, Sequoia, the inventor of the Cherokee alphabet, did die in Mexico, or he actually disappeared in Mexico. And I think people have been trying to figure out exactly what happened to him for a long time.
Where could you get the story of that?
Excuse me?
Where could one get the story of that?
I believe a Cherokee history that focused on removal, which is they're a kind of euphemism for the, you know, the Cherokees being kicked out of the southeast, would talk about that, because I think it happened pretty late in the mid 19th century. A book by someone like Angie Debo, D-E-B-O.
Fascinating. Well, keep up the good work, please.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for the call this afternoon. I want to mention another book, Elizabeth, that people might find interesting. Sometime back here on the Afternoon Magazine, and I think I can get the date, or at least the week that it was, the week of February 23rd in our archives at WILL.UIUC.edu. That week of this year, 2004, I spoke with a scientist by the name of Spencer Wells, and he's written a book called The Journey of Man, A Genetic Odyssey, and it contains a chapter about the role of culture in our genetic odyssey. And he is a man, he's a scientist who's interested in genetics, but he's also very interested in language and tracing our roots, how we moved out, you know, our ancestry going all the way back to Africa, and then how man and woman moved out across the globe. And language offers keys to, or a key to, our genetic odyssey.
Right, exactly. I think people are currently using language as a, I think there was an article in the New York Times today about using language to reconstruct these kind of ancient journeys that we took.
Yeah. Let's see if we can get one more caller in here this afternoon before we're out of time. Line one, a listener in Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Just about the removal of the Cherokees, that would have been during the Jackson administration, so it would have been before 1836.
Yes.
And I wasn't aware of the fact that Sequoia had lived that late, but I suppose it's quite possible.
Sequoia invented, well, the language was invented in the, well, he invented it. It was sort of introduced or formally to the tribe in the 1820s.
Okay,
and so Sequoia made the journey over, he was removed, he made the journey to Oklahoma. There's a cabin in Salisa, Oklahoma, said to have been his. And then he decided to strike out and head to Mexico. It was a fairly old man to basically see if there might be a better place. Don't know what that says about Oklahoma.
Interesting thing about Sequoia, you know, he's the only man ever to have invented a phonetic language. And it was the first time that anyone had done it since the Phoenicians and the Arabs in the classical period.
Right. The Cherokee is a wonderful, wonderful syllabic language.
It's not syllabic. It's actually phonetic.
Right. Well, the Koreans have a syllabic language as well.
But that's not phonetic.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an alphabet of that sort. I think, too, the Chinese would not be the source of the American Indian, I mean, Native Americans, because they speak a tonal language. And I don't believe any of the North American languages were tonal, were they?
Their tones are used in some of the languages, but they're not as tonal as Chinese. I was thinking that I used to make little notations when I was learning Cherokee, because there were a few things I learned where you had to use a tone to get the distinction, but it was much more informal, and it wasn't anywhere near as tonal as Chinese.
Hmm.
But who knows how much all these languages have changed since their distant root. Yeah, I agree. I don't think that Chinese would be the source, but there could be some source, on that, some connection in Asia.
Okay, very good. Well, there's where we're going to have to leave it because we're out of time. Elizabeth, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth C. has been our guest. She is the author of Searching for Lost City on the Trail of America's Native Languages. The book is published by the Lions Press. You'll find her on the web at www.elizabethc.com. ElizabethC.com. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. 7 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade, another interesting day. Futures in the bean pit anywhere between 4 and 10 cents higher for the day. Corn futures managed to hold in the $3 range for all of those gains, although the deferred contracts did take some losses into the $2 area. At some point in the day, they managed to come back. Let's take a look at what the numbers actually look like on the settlement prices. From the wheat pit, the March contract, and a high today of 377, a low at 371.5. A settlement price there at 372. They were down a penny on the day. July futures, 380. The high, the low at 375. A settlement price, 375.5, down one. And the September contract up 3/4. 383.75. The high, the low at 380. A settlement price for the September wheat at 380.25. Once again, it was 3/4 higher. December futures, 391. The high, the low at 388. A settlement price at 389. They were up a half. And the March contract in the wheat pit, 393.25. High, low at 390, settled 391.5. They were a penny higher on the day. The May corn now 308.75. The high, the low at 304.25. Settlement price at 305.25. It finished 2.25 lower. July futures 312.5. The high, the low at 308.5. A settlement price at 309.5. Down a penny and 3/4 for the day. September contract 304.5. The high, the low at 301.25. Settlement price at 302. Settled down a penny and 1/4. From here on out, the lows are in the $2 range, although everything settled above that in the $3 range with the exception of the December 05 contract. Now, the December 04 contract, this is the plant, the crop you'll put in the ground this spring, $3.50 the high, low at 297.5, and it did have a settlement price at 298.5, penny and a half lower for the day. The March futures in the corn pit, $3.25, the higher, the low at 297.75, the settlement price at 298.5. They were down a half a cent, or 1.5 for the day. May futures in the corn pit, $3.50, the high, the low at 299, settlement price at 299.75, down a penny and a half. And July, 301.5, the high, the low at 299.5. A settlement price for July 05 corn, $3 even, down a penny and a quarter. December futures for the 05 contract year, half a cent higher for the day, 269 the high, the low at 267.5. A settlement price for that Dease 05 corn contract, 268. A settlement price a half cent higher. May futures in the outpit, 164.5, high, low at 161.5. And a settlement price at 162. They were a penny and 3/4 lower. The July futures at 169.25. 1/4 high, low at 166, a settlement at 166, down a penny and three quarters. From the soy complex, the nearby May contract at 9.96 and three quarters cent high. A low at 9.75 and a half, a settlement price at 9.89. They finished 10 and three quarters higher on the day. July soybeans, 9.86 high, low at 9.66, a settlement price at 9.78 and three quarters, 12 and a half cents higher. And the August futures, 9.36 and three quarters the high, the low at 9.18, settlement price at 9.31. They were up 12 on the day. And the September futures, 10 and a half higher, 8.45 the high, the low at 8.30 and a half, a settlement price 8.41. Once again, that September contract up 10 and a half. The November on out, kicking and screaming just a bit, but they're following suit as well. 7.59 and three quarters the high, the low at 7.49. Dragged higher, 4 and 3 quarters up at 7.56 and 3 quarters for the November beans. January beans, 7.58 the high, the low at 7.50. A settlement price at 7.56. They were up 6 in the March. Soybeans for 05, 7.50 the high, the low at 7.42. A settlement price at 7.47 and a half. They managed a 3-cent gain on the day. The May bean meal at 3.05.80 on the high, the low at 2.97.50. And a settlement price at 3.02.10, up 4.30. July futures in the bean meal pit at 3.03.20 high, low at 2.94. Settlement price at 299.80. They were up 570. Now here's the loser in the bean pit for the day. May oil, 33.95 the high, the low at 33.50. A settlement price at 33.57. They were down 18. The July off 7, 33.77 the high, the low at 33.35. July oil settled 33.50 on the day. And once again, they were down 7. Here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Everything today on the upside today on the Merc. Todd, March feeder cattle, 90.50 the high, 89.90 the low, 90.50 the settlement, that up 65. April, 89.55 the high, 88.30 the low, 89.32 and a half the settlement, that up 137 and a half. May, 88.20 the high, 86.95 the low, 88.10 the settlement, that up 130. August feeder cattle, 89 even the high, 88.15 the low, 88.95 the settlement, that up 87 and a half. March live cattle, 86.70 the high, 85.15 the low, 86.70 the settlement, that up 160. April, 82.70 the high, 81.20 the low, 82.62 and a half the settlement, that up 177 and a half. June, 77.45 the high, 76.15 the low, the settlement, 77.35, that up 137 and a half. August live cattle, 75.15 the high, 74.42 and a half the low, the settlement 75.10, that up 67 and a half. April lean hog, 65.35 the high, 64.32 and a half the low, 65.30 the settlement, that up 117 and a half. May, 65.40 the high, 63.60 the low, 65.27 and a half the settlement, that up 177 and a half. June, 70.60 the high, 69.25 the low, 70.45 the settlement, that up 112 and a half. July lean hog, 66.47 and a half the high, the low 65.50, the settlement 66.47 and a half, that up 65. March pork bellies, 98.80 the high, 96.20 the low, 98.60 the settlement, that up 190. May bellies, 98.10 the high, 95.90 the low, 97.65 the settlement, that up 120. The Dow up 23 points, the NASDAQ 4 lower, the S&P 500 up a fraction.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM.